So I should say that even though this is about NCDs, I assume when I look at the front that you might be afraid that we've got some communicable diseases. I usually sit at the back anyway myself. So I go by Neil, even though you mentioned my first name, Akshay, and I should add that I'm no longer the director of the Global Health Office at Western University. There are a few other affiliations that I have there. But when you talked about stemming the tide, somehow that analogy, are we missing the boat, came naturally. And when I say we, I'm not referring to those of us in this room. I'm referring to what we consider the global agenda, as is given to us by various foundations and various international bodies, that I wonder, as we look at NCDs, we'll see increasing pressures to look at things which aren't necessarily evidence-based. I have no conflicts of interest to declare, although I think I'm going to try to mention some conflicts of interest that others might have to declare. When I look at objectives, I'd like us to think about, when we think about interventions in terms of NCDs, what is the efficacy and benefit of the interventions that we're proposing to institute? What are the numbers needed to treat, and what is the level of evidence? And often we don't feel that we have to actually state that. What are the costs that we know of, or harms? They may be financial or health harms or harms to health systems. We have to think about what we know and what we might not know now but might be able to guess on the basis of past experience or evidence. We have to look at the evidence that we have and who generates that, and who stands to gain from things. So I hope by the examples that I'll give you, that I'll get you to think a little bit differently about how you view evidence when it comes to interventions with NCDs. So I'll be talking about the global burden of disease, the costs of NCDs, some frameworks for decision-making, pushes for development of new technologies or drugs. And I think that there is a lot on the global agenda that is driven by corporate interests, and those interests use fear sometimes as a tactic in terms of getting us to decide about interventions. And then I'll talk a little bit about things from my own experience as a clinician in terms of evidence or lack thereof in terms of interventions with regard to cancer, heart disease. And finally, just conclude by reminding you of social determinants of health, but I think you've been reminded by each presentation, so we won't spend too much time on that. Many of you have seen the global burden of disease, and I think Chris Murray's group at the University of Washington is wonderful in terms of talking about how we are going to have an increasing incidence of heart disease, diabetes, cancers, and you mentioned also mental health issues, in particular depression, as causing a disease in the world as time goes on. We have many messages in the popular media talking about the costs of these things becoming astronomical. The AHA saying that the costs in the U.S. will go to more than $800 billion for heart disease. Dementia, according to the RAND Corporation, is supposed to top cancer and heart disease in cost very soon, if you think about care, not just medical treatment. The bottom line here is the same. Dementia is among the most costly of diseases to society, and we need to address this if we're going to come to terms with the cost to the Medicare and Medicaid system. And in Canada, as well as here, and as Gopal mentioned, we think about diabetes. And this is from the Canadian Diabetes Association, like the ADA here. And we have 2.7 million people in 2010. This is projected to rise by 50% within 10 years. So these are all numbers that scare us. They're reasons for concern. The Canadian Diabetes Association has this report, and they start off with reasons for concern, and then reasons for hope at this tipping point. This report itself has certain funding, which is declared at the back. So when we see, I'm not saying that these things aren't serious, but it's in terms of when we look at the treatment that they propose, this might be influenced by those who are funding things. The NCD Alliance report, again, good stuff with the World Heart Federation and various other bodies. The Alliance targets basically to reduce premature mortality from NCDs by 25%. Many of the things in blue are things that most of us would say are likely going to be helpful, but underpinning all of this, drug therapy and getting more coverage for that and developing of technologies, according to the NCD Alliance. And if we look at their members, so not just the International Diabetes Federation and World Heart Federation, various supporters, and you might even look at who supports the supporters. Livestrong, I guess, is one of the supporters here. I guess that's Lance Armstrong's foundation, isn't it?
Yeah.
And which has done a lot of good work, I should say. Many private sector supporters. Again, when they have reports, you may want to look at where that comes from. When they say it's time to act on this global emergency, and they say 4 in 5 deaths from NCDs now occur in low and middle income countries, without decisive action, the NCD burden threatens to undermine the benefits of improved standards of living, education, and economic growth in many countries. We can no longer ignore the burden that cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancers, and chronic respiratory disease is placing on countries that are least equipped to deal with them. The advantages that stand to be gained from the strength of strategic partnerships will contribute towards a more effective global response to NCDs. So I think that we have to look at what these strategic partnerships are. And so again, the WHO has taken things from the NCD coalition. Again, the same sorts of targets that is mentioned in their monitoring framework. Essential medicines and technologies, providing more coverage for those. When we look at their monitoring framework, the risk factors that we've talked about, but look at the things on the right. The first thing there is cervical cancer screening, which is, of course is important, but we notice other NCD medicines and technologies at the top, HPV vaccine, and things like that. So I would argue that some of these things, when we look at the evidence, may be based on the agenda of people. We look at the Global Atlas on Disease by the WHO. After talking about a few of the risk factors, they say, well, raised blood pressure is an issue, raised blood sugar is an issue, raised blood cholesterol is an issue, and then after that, social determinants may be an issue too. So we look at the ordering of priorities. The CDC also, again, after tobacco control, looking at cervical cancer, virtually all cases are linked to persistent infection with HPV. Again, the assumption, if you look at the CDC's website, is getting that HPV vaccine out there is the most important thing. We see more quality measures that are developing, and within the U.S., you find all of these constructs of ideal cardiovascular health. But very few people actually meet the criteria for cardiovascular health with the AHA. So one out of 1,933 participants in this one study met all 7 components of cardiovascular health. So we see ourselves as falling short much more. In diabetes, there's been also an increase in this one article talked about the sudden acceleration of diabetes quality measures. But is approaching, trying to get our numbers better, the best way of dealing with these diseases and reducing the burden of these diseases? I would argue the evidence doesn't point to that. With cancer, again, we're looking at cancer as not being non-communicable, but often communicable. And so people are saying, well, we should be dealing with H. pylori. We should be dealing with HPV. Hepatitis B, of course, I think there's good evidence for, but for many of the other things that we're trying to deal with, even treatment of H. pylori has a certain downside. So we have to look at the agenda of the people who are bringing these issues up. And it's not saying that all of these things that I've mentioned are not issues, but how strong an issue they are compared to some of the other issues that we've mentioned. Gavi, again, trying to get more HPV vaccine, and it's nice that they've reduced the cost of HPV vaccine to developing world countries, but and they're willing to pay for that in countries like Rwanda, but after a few years of payment, they're going to leave local health systems with actually having to pay for things. And we have to look if is that the best way, or is it looking at getting access to pap smears, which already have been proven time and time again to reduce deaths from cervical cancer. So we're moving away from looking at those lifestyle type things and dealing with chronic diseases to looking at technologies. Where are the pushes? We get it from the drug companies, which will sell more drugs. Device companies will sell more of their devices. Doctors, like myself, are paid more when people come in. Patient advocacy groups also stand to benefit in some ways. And politicians and decision makers benefit from doing something. But we have to ask whether that's actually the thing to do. And when there's contrary evidence, often that gets buried. It's not published in major journals, and it's not taken up by the popular media. And I'll talk a bit more about that, the corporate agenda within the U.S. I think I'm going to stay away from that. That's probably more rhetoric than anything, but we have to be suspicious of that. We find many corporations not paying taxes and actually advocating for health systems in other countries for more privatization and, again, spending money on things that may not help. And when governments try to invest in their infrastructure and education and reducing disparities, that's opposed by the same corporations. And within the U.S. that happens also. Just want to give you a few examples that are more clinical examples. And again, this may, for some people, this may be a bit uncomfortable. The U.S., there's been a big push for mammograms, particularly in the age 40 to 50 age category for annual mammograms, not really shown to actually influence mortality in a positive way. And Canada and most other countries don't have breast cancer screening below age 50. The cost of this of the current policy is about $8 billion. We'd add another $3 billion if people follow that recommendation to have annual mammograms here between 40 and 50. With looking at adopting a policy that Canada and many other countries have, and the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends, you'd actually save $2.5 billion. And in terms of real risk, what it means is that if we accept the evidence that's out there, you'd really be giving mammograms to more than 2,000 women to actually prevent one cancer death between age 40 and 50. And I could talk a bit more about that because I know people will be skeptical about that too. And even between 50 and 70, it's a little bit dicey. And you could look at the Cochrane Review, which we use in medicine to look at evidence. Even between 50 and 70, they say that you have to screen a lot of women to actually prevent a breast cancer death. PSA screening, again, not shown in major U.S. and European studies to actually help reduce death from prostate cancer. When we look at mental health issues, antidepressants as being our mainstay of treatment. If you look at a study published in the New England Journal, the Kirsch study, not our SSRIs, which are in some ways our gold standard, not really shown to influence depression as much as we would like to think. The same would be true for second-generation antipsychotics, which are much more expensive than first-generation antipsychotics. Treatment for dementia with Aricept-type drugs, the actual advantage to these things over placebo is rather minimal. So cardiovascular disease is what I was going to talk about too, and the data is rather similar for that. For people who are considered at low risk for cardiac disease in terms of taking a statin, you end up having, this is from Dalhousie University, you end up having to treat more than 50 people for 5 years to prevent one heart attack. In terms of primary prevention, a person who hasn't had a heart attack. And we have a push to treat more people with the statin drugs also in developing countries. You actually get an increase of diabetes of probably 2% with that. You get muscle aches. There are harms to things. So as we try to push this as the way that countries will deal with their heart disease, we have to look at that. Mild hypertension, treating people below a blood pressure of 160 over 100 down to 140 over 90. The Cochrane Review again says that this did not reduce total mortality. So as we look at tighter targets and more targets, we may not actually be benefiting ourselves. When we look at tighter control for diabetes, again, tighter control also means more episodes of hypoglycemia. And it hasn't been shown, again, by the Cochrane Review to lead to any significant reduction in death from any cause when you go to lower targets. And there was a recent study in diabetics, per se, treating their blood sugars down to targets, to what we consider normal targets from where they were before. They actually had an increase in deaths over 4 years of treatment, and they had to stop the study looking at diabetics. Looking at treating the cholesterol beyond the statin agents, again, they found that this did not reduce the rate of cardiovascular events, MIs, or non-fatal strokes. Treating the blood sugar, again, blood pressure, again, in diabetics. Theoretically, a great thing, but practically not known to make a major difference. So who's, even this evidence itself is somewhat biased. Pharmaceutical companies are involved in the conception and funding of studies, and that affects study design, interpretation, analysis, the writing up, the reporting, the publishing, the dissemination. So there's a systematic bias even in the medical literature, and I was citing the examples from the medical literature. Even our evidence probably is stronger than what actually happens in real life. Companies end up doing studies of their drug versus other drugs, and we see a lot of Me Too drugs out there. And so almost 20 years ago, a study of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories found all 56 published commercially funded trials showed a company's drug to be as good or better than the comparator treatment. And there are various reasons how you can design your study so that'll happen. With second generation antipsychotics, there's a study called Why Olanzapine Beats Risperidone, Risperidone Beats Quetiapine, and Quetiapine Beats Olanzapine. And basically, the trials are able to, with second-generation antipsychotics, show the same sort of thing. Then we look at guideline panels, and we see that this is the 2004 update, which said, I think they went from 13 million to 30 million Americans requiring cholesterol-lowering medication. The people who wrote the guidelines, many had up to 5 different conflicts of interest with different companies. We look at this country here, and it's this system that we're trying to export to developing countries. You're spending twice as much as what we spend in Canada and receiving lower benefit if we look at your life expectancy or infant mortality figures, and the cost of different procedures. And I'm not sure I could vouch for those stats. This came from the New York Times, I believe. But you are paying more for specific procedures. There's more spent on administration, inefficient delivery of service here in the U.S., and inflated prices. One of my patients came back for a service that would have cost, it would have been covered by our government insurance, just came back from Atlanta, $200,000 for a week in a hospital after an MI. And this is something that I've never seen in Canada. We don't have debt related to health expenses. So we're seeing more of that. We're seeing that when we look at the countries without universal health coverage, we see this country and many other countries. I would argue that that's really what we have to be looking for. We have to be looking for balancing the amount of having more equity in terms of economics, and we notice that the richer societies are overall, the healthier they are, GDP per capita and life expectancy, education being improved in countries, that's where we have to spend the money, not on these technologies. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Arial, for that wonderful evidence-based presentation in terms of providing an alternate viewpoint. Thank you so much. I want to thank the panelists over here for their excellent presentations, and now want to open up the floor. So if you have a question to any one of the panelists or all the panelists, please feel free to do so. We have about almost about 18 minutes. We have 18 minutes. We are on time. I thank the panelists for sticking to the time. So we have 18 minutes to go. So, questions? And when you are responding, I would request you to use the microphone and then also repeat the question so that it gets recorded. Thank you. Please. The question is, what can you do about provider productivity vis-a-vis the needs of the patients to be cared for within that office visit, which usually ranges anywhere from 14 to 18 minutes nationally?
The health center is essential to deliver quality of healthcare, but we have to rethink the health center. We have to work as a team. We have to reorganize, re-engineer the process to deliver healthcare. So they see you, or maybe they see the nurse, and then they see the doctor, and there has to be a way in which each other's person's roles are re-engineered. And we haven't done that yet because doctors like you, we are employees of the system. So it's very hard to change the system from inside unless somebody starts jumping up and down.
Just to, I think I'm loud enough. I'm using my outdoor voice.
It has to be.
Oh, record it. Okay. He's making me get nice.
Just to add on to what Elvira said, and I think you bring up a very important issue. But see, as you know, the providers are controlled, remote controlled by the insurance companies. So if you are allotted. So it's, I'm sure, like as a physician, I would like to spend more time with the patients. But if there's somebody cracking the whip behind, it gets harder. So I think there needs to be a dialogue with also the insurance companies and other stakeholders. So it's just not the provider. I think everybody needs to come to the table to see what can be done, which is efficient in time management. At the same time, you're not letting people fall through the cracks because you're really wasting time and money because they come back with a bigger problem.
I was going to stay silent here, I think that, yes, physicians have to be educated better, and the system has to be arranged better so that physicians would have more time with people, but beyond that is something societal. I think that society expects physicians to be the ones telling them what to do. It's not really capacity building with other health professionals and more respect for other health professionals, but beyond that, to people taking more control and not expecting messages from outside too. And as you say, our success in terms of lifestyle management things, whether it be smoking cessation or dealing with weight, is rather poor. I'm not sure it's all due to lack of time with a physician, though.
I think the lady behind and then you, sir.
I just want to respond to that. I don't think it's about the provider, it's about the structure. Mm-hmm. So when you have one place gaining benefit from vision and a different place gaining benefit from vision, then you're going to have to decide feeding. There are some structural changes in the ABA which will help. Like if somebody said, okay, if you have a big mission to lock over a certain amount of time, you're not going to get paid, which makes the hospital interested in prevention. And there have been changes in discharges already based on that. You have to look at the structure.
Thank you. Sir?
Yeah, also commenting, because this is important. I'm a physician at a community health center, and I congratulate the management of your community health center for hiring you. Because no one's paying for your services. There's no insurance company, third party payer paying for your insurance, so for your services. So what they apparently figured out is if they shave off a minute or two from of the provider's time, if that provider sees a couple more patients a day, then they make enough money to hire you. And what you're doing is probably more important than what their provider is.
Thank you, sir. Question? Yeah, please. The question is, what kind of priorities need to be set up in terms of policy, both in the United States and elsewhere?
Thank you for that question. I'd like to take the United, the global part. Is one of the things is the policies. There are the CARICOM countries, the Caribbean countries, who first started this whole initiative to have healthy days across all the countries, especially for women. And they had local women leaders, and they started training the community health workers and the social workers to reach out, to talk to them as to what can be done. So the CARICOM countries have really come a long way, and actually they were the ones who kind of co-sponsored this whole, set the ball rolling for this whole session, which Gopal mentioned about in the UN 2 years ago, in 2011, that was the only second time in the history of the UN General Assembly that a health issue was taken up and a special session was denoted to that, devoted to that. The first one was HIV/AIDS. But bottom line, long story short, They are trying to have more people work at grassroots and come back and tell them what is being affected. So globally, and this also is being replicated and kind of tweaked to suit the needs of the other country. So actually, if you go online and look at the WHO site and go under the communicable diseases, you can see the latest update and to what's happening. But I know because personally, the one of the ambassadors for St. Lucia worked with his other counterparts, the other Caribbean countries, to really get this going. And also they started having healthy days where they showed mothers, because a lot of the Caribbean countries, the food is very rich in calories, like it's fried, it's like almost the Asian food. So they said, like, don't have the fried plantains, like you can bake them, you know, simple things like that. So these are some of the steps they have a health day where the whole island or the whole country, kind of everybody walks. And then you have like a sticker, like how many miles you walk. So they try to do that. So this has really started, you know, catching on. So that's something which they are really incorporating more globally.
I'm going to take action. It's not like whatever you want to do. Mike. It's recorded. You're on candid camera.
Jet lag. Now, I just wanted to say that independent of what policy there is, the important thing is that wherever each of us are, that we take action and do the best you can. It's important that we need to understand more about the interaction of all these behavioral risk factors and how they work, and we need to do more epidemiological assessments of each community to really understand how we can design programs or implement services that really meet their needs, not just one size fits all.
Question, sir.
I worked on the drafting of the ACA in the Senate, and I'd like to suggest it was a possible vote against big loss of the bill, and above all else, probably was the loss of the original health board that's international to most of us. We worked on the IPAP, and that just became another SGR cutting sort of mechanism. But no one's willing to raise taxes, no one's willing to cut benefits. Things like the Ryan plan don't work for us. A lot of prevention doesn't save money. The reality is most prevention, as we score it under the federal system, doesn't. And maybe even outside of that, it doesn't. But then we get into situations where we'll pay $250,000 of probage to give a let's imagine our 70 another 3 months of life. So we won't spend $5,000 to prevent it because we won't deal with the issue of years of life and cost. As soon as we start talking about values, we get into quality issues, and I think most Americans don't buy the quality of life judgment, and we go down that road. But there's just nothing else that's going to do it except a look at both efficacy and quality into a value equation. And when you talk to people in the street, I talk to my students at the university now, I've left the Senate, even the, I'll say, the least stellar of my students get that concept. They don't want to pay more taxes. They don't want to see benefits cut. But that means some kind of judgment. And that also means that, you know, I've sat with the Heart Association, Cancer Association, every group on the Hill, we have people advocating Christian Science is one of the benefits in the health bill. I mean, there was no end to the pushing and pulling until we do something like Senator Daschle proposes that you take this out of the Congress. And you take it out of the interest groups that people pay for campaigns, to be very blunt. I spent 7.5 years there. And you start saying, we're going to have some experts who can't have conflicts of interest, and they're going to evaluate the evidence. And that means that sometimes I'm not getting to prevent life. I might believe that I want, but we're going to triage it some way. Canada does it. Europe does it. Some of them do it in a way that maybe we don't, do not accept in our country. But until the American public gets behind that kind of effort, we're not going anywhere.
But you're absolutely right, because to give you one example of this, when you look at the pie, where the dollar comes from, just reducing it to a pie chart of a dollar comes from, where the dollar goes, that hasn't changed since 1960 in terms of where the dollar goes. 31% of it goes into hospitals. About 20.8, somewhere around that, goes into clinician and lab services. So add those two, 50 cents out of each dollar goes to two of those things, where it is very difficult to show what is their impact on prevention. 3.4% goes to public health, and this is from 1960 onwards. You can look at the pie chart every decade, it's pretty much the same in terms of slicing it. What's different is the pie has grown. So now we have crossed over the extra large pizza into a bigger, I don't know what is bigger than an extra large pizza. We have gone into that. We spent 1% of that, $2.8 trillion in 2010, in terms of actually teaching people how to stay healthy, how to modify their risk behaviors if they happen to be risk behaviors, and to strengthen behaviors if they happen to be protective behaviors. So we have the data which we need today, even though the evidence base is not so good as we want, but the basic things, which I think the best way to think about it is what Robert Fulghum wrote. Whatever I wanted to learn, I learned it in kindergarten. There is no greater message in terms of looking at prevention from a non-communicable disease perspective, except if we can let go of the three things which affect our taste: fat, salt, sugar. Extremely difficult to do. And that's why when we talk about whether it is the United States, whether we talk about the developing countries, it doesn't make difference, because we all seem to have been born with the same taste buds.
And we can take a really short view of that, too.
Yeah.
You look through the weekend, you look through the next year, Congress looks 5 or 10 years, you don't look beyond that window.
Yeah, I guess it is difficult coming from coming down south here, moving further east, actually going from Detroit to Windsor, you actually go south, for those of you who know geography, so sometimes we're further south. But anyway, coming across here, that I do think that societally it is different, and what you expect of your politicians is different than in many other countries, and so it does make it challenging. But I was going to ask about the Oregon experiment. Has anybody here been in touch with that? You know a little bit about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. To all this was, Oregon was considered, when I moved to Pittsburgh and went to medical school there, to
the Oregon experience was Hillary as basically rationing and death panels and all that. That was the first experiment in that kind of thing.
But that's why it's so interesting and relevant. Because we need actual experiments. It sounds horrible, but we need to type of evidence.
We make decisions anyway. We're rationing even with the AC experiment.
And we need to have additional evidence and evidence that doesn't support what is possible. It's very important. Maybe it's not
possible. One, I got Hillary on the Wall Street Journal because they suggested that given someone generic omeprazole, maybe that should be done without a copay. If they wanted to get Nexium, we could just double the dose instead of paying $125 a month. And I can tell you the drug companies and any interest group that you hit with that sort of policy, even though it's good for the taxpayer and the patient, that's the big obstacle.
And R is a dirty word in U.S. healthcare system. Rationing is a dirty word, but the reality is, as you all point out, it exists. If I don't have insurance, I'm rationed, whether I like it or I don't like it, and that's the reality of the healthcare system. Other questions or comments, please? Any other questions, comments? Again, I want to thank the panel as well as you all for staying through the whole session and for your wonderful contributions. Thank you all. Enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you.